This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Kevin Wilson's debut novel, The Family Fang, is getting a lot of buzz. It's been reviewed in Time Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, and The Wall Street Journal. Kevin himself was recently profiled in The New York Times. The strangeness of Kevin's story has a lot to do with all the attention. The narrative revolves around Caleb and Camille Fang, performance artists who like nothing better than to see people squirm, and they made their two children part of the act. Like when they arranged for their son and daughter to take the lead roles in the high school production of Romeo and Juliet. Caleb and Camille sit in the audience anticipating the moment when brother and sister are forced to publicly kiss. These kinds of hijinks are great fun for the parents, but of course leave their children scarred. The Family Fang examines the weird relationship between parents and kids and tries to answer the question, what happens to art when artists have children? Author Kevin Wilson is going to be in Raleigh at Quail Ridge Books on August 25th at 7:30, but he is here with us now. In fact, he is at the University of Mississippi joining us on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Where did the idea for this novel come from?
Well, it really began with the birth of my own son, Griff. When he was born, I was trying to figure out what my novel was going to be, and it was such a struggle the first year of his life. I felt like everything that I did was wrong. I felt like everything that I did was damaging him, whether it was trying to get him to eat or sleep. And as I was going through that, I was thinking a lot about what it means to be a family, what it means to be a parent, and what effect a parent has on a child. I kept thinking I'm ruining Griff forever. And so when I started writing this novel, I wanted to create a pair of parents who were worse than myself in some ways.
Well, I would say this, Kevin. If you ask Griff when he's 13, he will confirm all of your doubts and suspicions. That's
okay,
number
one. So.
But now these parents are crazy. They're artists who then become – who decide that they're not going to let their kids wreck their lives. They're going to turn them into their art. And they do lots of weird stunts. The kids are in the middle of them, humiliating them. And so let me ask you, if your relationship with your family was anything like that? Was it that crazy?
Well, I don't think my parents would like me to say that it was that crazy.
Yeah, but if they did that to you, you can.
Well, they didn't do that exactly.
The
thing that was interesting about our family was that I grew up with my mother and father and my sister, and our family was very insular in many ways. We created a world for ourselves. My parents, we were their best friends. There were not a lot of people that came to our house, and every night we would play cards and watch TV and make up games. And in many ways, I think my parents allowed us the freedom to be weird if we wanted to. And we had this safe place to be strange and not feel judged. And that was wonderful. It was a fantasy world. And my parents very much created a place for us where they wanted us to understand that the outside world was not nearly as fun as what was going on in our house. And that was great until I then had to leave and go to college, and then I realized just how maybe terrifying the outside world was.
Can't always be like that. Now,
exactly.
You talked about the impetus behind this book being your fears and anxieties about raising children the right way, and certainly a theme in the book takes a little turn, the idea that as an artist, your art is going to change and maybe just be killed by the presence of these big responsibilities. Is that something that you felt personally before when this child came into your life, you as a writer?
Well, it was definitely something that I worried about when we found out that Griff was going to be a part of our lives. And I wondered, am I going to be able to keep writing? And my wife is a poet, and she had those same fears. And I think these are not concerns just for artists. I think all parents wonder what they're giving up in order to welcome a child into their lives. And but for me, I thought, I have a deadline for a novel that I have to write, and now I have this baby in our house that I have to take care of. And I really did worry if it was going to ruin my work. And, you know, what I actually found out was, for this novel especially, Griff made the book possible. I wouldn't have written it without him. So for me, he did not kill art at all. I mean, he made art possible.
In a far different way than for our friends Camille and Caleb. Will you read for us?
Sure. I'm going to read a small little section. This is a flashback to when Annie and Buster were children, and this is one of the art pieces. It's called The Sound and the Fury, March 1985. artists Caleb and Camille Fang. Buster was holding his drumsticks upside down, but Mr. and Mrs. Fang thought this made it even better. The boy spastically pressed his foot on the pedal that operated the bass drum and flinched with each percussive note. Annie strummed her guitar, her fingers already aching not 5 minutes into the concert. For two people who had never learned to play their instruments, they were managing to perform even more poorly than expected. They shouted the lyrics of the song that Mr. Fang had written for them, their voices off-key and out of sync. Though they had only learned the song a few hours before their performance, they found it easy to remember the chorus, which they sang to the astonished onlookers. "It's a sad world. It's unforgiving," they yelled at the top of their lungs. "Kill all parents so you can keep living." In front of them, an open guitar case held some coins and a single dollar bill. Taped to the inside of the case was a handwritten note that read, "Our dog needs an operation. Please help us save him." And what you find after that is that Caleb and Camille are planted in the audience and will begin to heckle the two children until chaos ensues.
They're going to heckle. So they've set their kids up, essentially, to put on a crummy street performance, which they will then begin to heckle and then force onlookers to take sides.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they do. And
it ends badly.
It ends badly because, you know, you're hoping that all of the onlookers will rush to the aid of these children, but really only half of them do.
Right.
And the other half don't. It's kind of a remarkable moment, and there's also a moment in there. They're supposed to be filming this whole thing, and they realize the camera was broken, right? And then Camille says, "Oh, it's okay. It's just for us."
Exactly. This is the one moment where they record everything so that it can be shown in art galleries and viewed by other people. And this one, there is no record of it. And yet the Fangs are so happy with how it went that they believe this is just for the family. This was good enough.
It's an interesting view of the artist when art as narcissism, when it's just for us and not for the rest of the world. That's when intrusions like those little greasy children can be kind of in the way.
Exactly.
It's a fascinating look. But the other thing you do, now we've sort of set this up, and I should say the book treats Camille and Caleb far more subtly than what I just did and what you might have gathered from that scene. In a way, because they're defending art, there's a kind of nobility about them throughout the book, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, I found myself against my own will sympathizing with Caleb and Camille in many ways. And one of the things that I sympathize with them about is they want to be artists. They are artists. That is what they love. And yet these children enter into their lives and they make the decision that they're going to take the two things that they love the most, their art and their family, and they're going to find a way to do them both, to put them together. And what they think they're doing for their children is giving them the greatest gift, which is their art. And it's just the problem is they don't understand just how badly this affects their children. But in their minds, I really think that they think they're being incredibly kind and generous parents. And so I feel for them because they really have no idea just how horrible they might be.
The novel gives us clues to where the lines are, even if they don't see them. The one is the kind of narcissism about, well, so what if nobody sees it? We loved it. And then there's another scene where autonomy, I think, is another big question, whether or not the children are participants in this great kind of collaboration that they see. But the kids really don't have much choice. And there's a great scene in there where Buster enters and wins a beauty pageant dressed as a girl. This is a young boy. He's dressed as a girl. It's supposed to be a put-on. He's supposed to expose it at the end so that the judges and everybody looks silly for having picked a boy in this girl's beauty pageant. But Buster really wants to win. Tell us about the importance of that scene.
Well, it's so much that the parents have forced their children to take part in these artistic enterprises, and their goal is to make it seem incredibly real so that the people around them are affected by it emotionally. And the problem is when you take this child and you put him into this performance and you tell him this has got to be real, he believes it. And so when he is in the running to become Little Miss Crimson Clover, he wants that crown. And when he gets that crown, he doesn't care about the kind of artistic statement that they're trying to make. He's supposed to give up the crown and throw it into the audience. He wants the crown. This has become reality for him. And that moment when the parents relent and they let him keep it is the moment when, you know, Buster gets something that he wants. He, for taking part in the art, he gets to have the thing that he desires.
Then there's another scene where Buster gets sick at dinner, and that I think is a real turning point. It was for me as a reader, where you get to see the parent. Tell us about that scene and what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, there's a moment when the parents take Annie and Buster to this fancy restaurant in Atlanta, and they tell them, we're going to do something, but we're not going to tell you what. You just need to be prepared. And the stress and the worry over waiting for this event to happen causes Buster such internal distress that he throws up his food. And Caleb and Camille are delighted. They believe that Buster is so inherently an artist that he made this event happen against his own will. And the parents are so happy. And Annie and Buster are terrified. I think for the first time they really understand that their parents might not have their best interests at heart. And for me, when I wrote that scene, it was the moment when I think it becomes clear that there is some form of abuse going on in this relationship. There's some form of emotional abuse that Caleb and Camille are doing to these kids, and it becomes less funny after that.
And the flower of this abuse is that both kids end up achieving some material success in their lives, but emotionally, of course, they're pretty well wrecked.
Right. You know, they choose these forms of art that are separate from their parents, and they are successful in some ways, but the problem is emotionally they have existed in a world where they were told to expect chaos at all times. And now that they're adults and they're away from their parents, they can't shake that feeling. They've been programmed to walk directly into chaos, and so they do that as adults, and it ends up kind of ruining their lives in many ways.
And that not knowing from minute to minute, not having control over your environment, is certainly one of the symptoms of children of alcoholic parents. And I'm wondering if you've done any kind of research in this, both in terms of the kind of theater of street theater or some of the psychiatric and psychological research on abused children. Did any of that go into this book?
I tried to do as I hate saying this, but I tried to do as little research as possible to write this book. And part of that was laziness. But the other part was I wanted to try and stay in my own head with this family. And I certainly understood I knew about performance art, and I kind of love performance art. And I knew about the ways in which parents who abuse their children, the ways in which that can affect a child as they grow up. From having read about it. But, you know, I tried to take just those slight tiny kernels and then, you know, plant them in my own head and see what happens. And this is what I came up with.
Did it? So now you're staying with this family, as you said, plant them in your own head, all the while you're having anxieties about raising your own child. Did you have to stop at some point, or did this make things worse for you?
I really think that it made things better to be able to spend time with this strange family and then leave that family behind and leave my study and then be with my own family helped me appreciate just what I had, how wonderful my wife was and the time that we had together and how wonderful my son was. The older he got, the more that he became a kind of singular person. He gained agency. It was beautiful to me. And so I think I wouldn't have appreciated one or the other if I didn't have both of them.
Did it reduce any of your anxieties about what you were doing to your son?
Well, I don't know if the book did, but I think the more you spend time with anything, you get used to it and you start to believe in yourself. And so as Griff got older and we hadn't killed him, I just thought, well, we're doing a great job. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. And that seemed to work for me. Somehow lightness entered into my life.
Right. Well, somebody's going to mess him up, so it might as well be you.
Why not?
That's the other way to look at this if you're really getting too just over the top. This is your first novel. You have a book of short stories. What was it like for you going from short story to novel?
It was very difficult in many ways. I think people think, well, if you've written short stories, surely you can write a novel. And that's not the case. I think there's different things at play. And for short stories, for me, I tried to find a kind of easy entrance into the narrative and get the reader moving quickly. And I moved in as straight a line as possible to get to that explosive ending that kind of ruins the reader. That's what I tried to do. And with the novel, I had to keep reminding myself that I had so much more time and space to explore the characters and the nuances of the narrative. And so in many ways, writing the novel was just reminding myself that I had time. I didn't have to rush through these things. And it was really liberating. It allowed me to get to know these characters in a way I wouldn't have otherwise.
In the book, the Fangs seem to value making strange works of art. Is that something you can relate to?
I like wacky modes. I like strangeness. And I think part of that comes from a childhood of reading comic books and pulp novels where strangeness is the default mode. And when you grow up thinking of that as your narrative engine, you just gravitate towards those things. And luckily enough, the world is so bizarre and so strange that you can access that almost anywhere.
Well, thank you for adding yet one more strange family to the collection of weirdos who make up our world. Kevin, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a blast. Thank you.
Kevin Wilson, author of The Family Fang. He's going to be reading from the book and signing copies in Raleigh at Quail Ridge Books next Thursday, August 25th at 7:30. And just a little bit earlier, we were talking about the Center for Women's Mood Disorders. There will be an open house at the Center for Women's Mood Disorders on September 15th. And that is, you can find out more about that, by the way, at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can find a calendar to all the events mentioned on our program. Thank you for listening. State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix, Alex Granados, Isaac Davey Aronson. Jenny Mueller is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editors Lindsay Foster Thomas and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.